Welcome to the Federalist Society's Courthouse Steps podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Labor and Employment Law Practice Group, was recorded on Monday, November 4th, 2013, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to a special Courthouse Steps edition of the Practice Group's telephone conference call. On today's call, we'll be discussing a case argued in the Supreme Court today, Sandifer versus United States Steel Corp., a donning and doffing case. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. Please note that, as always, all expressions of opinion are those of the expert on today's call. Also, this call is being recorded for possible use as a podcast in the future. We welcome back to today's call the Honorable Tammy D. McCutcheon. She's the former administrator of the Wage and Hour Division of the United States Department of Labor and a shareholder here in the D.C. firm Littler Mendelson. She's going to give us some opening remarks, beginning with some background on the case and then discussion of today's argument. And then we will, as always, take questions from the audience. So please be getting ready with your questions. And with that, Ms. McCutcheon, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Dean. I also do want to reveal that I filed an amicus brief in this case, Sandifer versus U.S. Steel, on behalf of the Grocery Manufacturers Associating, supporting the respondents, U.S. Steel. This is, you know, it might seem odd that the Supreme Court is going to be deciding what is clothing, but that's what is happening today in this case. What does clothing mean, and does it include protective clothing that employees wear at work, such as flame-retardant jackets, flame-retardant pants, and things like hats, gloves, steel-toed boots, protected goggles? And this case involves a section of the FLSA that's a little bit obscure, but it is the only section within the FLSA that allows a collective bargaining agreement to trump the other rights of for overtime and minimum wage under the FLSA. So here's what Section 3.0 does. Normally, if the law or an employer requires an employee to come to work to change into protective clothing and gear needed to perform the work, in most circumstances, it's well established that that time must be paid. And in a lot of industries like meat processing, chicken processing, and here steel workers, it's not a little bit of time. It can be, you know, individually every day, it can be like 15 minutes a day, 12 minutes a day. But when you're talking, 15 minutes in the morning, 15 minutes at night, a half an hour a day, that can be 2.5 hours of overtime in a week times 52 weeks times the number of employees you have. And it really starts adds up to be some major money. However, in 1949, after a series of Supreme Court cases expanding the definition of what is work for which employees have to be paid, Congress passed an amendment to the FLSA known as Section 3.0. The section is 29 U.S.C. 2030, if you want to look it up. And what that section says, that if an employer and the union agree in a collective bargaining agreement or through a past existing practice or custom under the collective bargaining agreement, that the time employees spend in changing clothes, and that's the exact term, changing clothes, or washing up at the beginning or end of the workday need not be compensable. And that's what happened in this case for U.S. Steel. Actually, since 1947, 2 years before Section 3.0 was put into the FLSA, U.S. Steel and the steel workers have had a collective bargaining agreement which stated that employees would not be paid for preparatory and concluding activities. And the practice has always been, since that time, that employees at U.S. Steel are not paid for time spent donning and doffing their protective gear. Not liking the benefit of that bargain, some employees filed a class action lawsuit under the FLSA claiming that they should have been paid for that time, and the case began. Interestingly, the Steel Workers Union has never been a part of this case. They never intervened in the case. And in fact, after the case was started in 2008, there was another collective bargaining for a new contract, and the steel workers actually agreed to strengthen the language in the collective bargaining bargaining agreement by specifically stating that they're not, that employees would not be paid for donning and doffing of protective clothing. The U.S. In the district court, U.S. Steel won the issue of that their gear is clothing, but they lost on the issue of whether they had to spend pay employees for the time from putting on their clothing in the locker room and walking to their workstation. The Seventh Circuit ruled for U.S. Steel on all on both of those issues. The Supreme Court only took up the definition of clothing issue. And Judge Posner's decision is worth reading. It's very amusing. He had his one of his clerks put on the steel workers' protective clothing that was in an evidence box and pose for a picture, and that picture went into Judge Posner's opinion. Another interesting aspect of this case is the DOL flip-flopping. I think we actually heard a brand new position in court today, but the DOL has now flipped, and flopped again. The first time that the DOL issued guidance on what is clothing, which employer and union can bargain not to pay for, was under the Clinton administration, where they adopted a narrow view of the term clothing to exclude any type of protective gear like hats and gloves and boots. In the Bush administration in 2002, I issued an opinion letter revoking the prior one and adopting a broad definition of the word clothing. In 2010, the Obama administration revoked my letter and issued an administrator's interpretation, again narrowing the definition of what is clothes. And then, and this was pretty shocking to a lot of people, in this case, the Department of Labor actually filed an amicus brief on behalf of U.S. Steel, and they basically are taking a position very similar to what we took in the Bush administration. And in a footnote in their amicus brief, and these were a very close quote, we do not urge the court to defer to our 2010 administrator's interpretation. So they basically told the Supreme Court, you know, don't look behind the curtain, just consider what we're writing in this amicus brief. And as I will discuss later today in oral arguments, they actually modified their position again in an interesting way. Oral arguments were very interesting. One thing that I think struck everybody who was in the room is, although the government did appear and did take part of the oral arguments, none of the justices took the opportunity to ask them any questions about the DOL flip-flopping. Deference was not discussed at all. The attorney for the government did was asked a lot of really good questions and articulated a sort of a modified position, but was never taken to task or asked to explain the DOL's flip-flopping. So that was, I guess, a little bit of a disappointment too. So I found the oral arguments very interesting because they're the justices, based on the questions that they asked, they don't seem to have been broken down into what we normally would think of the justices that we would normally think would be advocates for the employees versus ones who would be advocates for the company. I know that the respondent employees' counsel must have been chagrined about maybe 30 seconds after he started his argument. Justice Ginsburg held up the picture of Judge Posner's clerk from the Seventh Circuit opinion and said, "Well, that looks like clothes to me." And I think when you're advocating for an employee and you have Justice Ginsburg say, "Well, I know it when I see it, and this looks like clothes," you've got to be concerned about whether you're going to win the case. Expressing a lot of skepticism, and let me back up, the position of the employees, the petitioners here, is that clothing cannot include any article that's designed to protect an employee from workplace hazards. So if the purpose and the function of the piece of clothing is to protect from a workplace hazard, it cannot be clothes, and employers have to pay for that time. They cannot bargain out of it. On the other side, the steel workers' position, and the one that I advocated in my amicus brief, was that clothing includes any article, any item, which the employee has to wear to be ready to work. And not distinguishing between, for example, a flame-retardant jacket and a pair of safety goggles or gloves or a pair of steel-toed boots. A lot of the justices express deep skepticism of the employee's definition, that it cannot include any item of clothing that has the that is designed to or has the purpose of protecting you from workplace hazards. Justice Sotomayor, for example, she appeared initially sympathetic. She was talking to the counsel for the petitioning employees and said, well, I do have an understanding that you're right, that clothing cannot include every item and everything, giving the examples of, for example, jewelry is not clothing, toupees are not clothing, makeup is not clothing, even though they do cover the body. And even if an employer said you have to wear earrings to work. But she also agreed, but she said she had a problem with items like a jacket or a pair of pants that look like clothing. That she had a problem with things that looked like clothes, like jackets and pants, not being included in the definition of clothing based on their purposes. She invited the petitioner employee's counsel to help her draw some other line, but he was not able to do that. He was not able to articulate, as he called it, a fallback position. So I think Sotomayor was very skeptical about the employee's position here, that even a jacket and a pair of pants can't be clothing if they're for a protective purpose. But she was also equally skeptical of the proposed definition from U.S. Steel and the employer amicus that includes everything that you're required to wear to be on the job. Justice Kagan also expressed a lot of skepticism about having a distinction based on that the gear is protective from workplace hazards. She indicated that she didn't understand how you could have two sets of clothes that were the same items, a jacket, and one of them would be clothing under the Section 3O, so you could exclude it from work time, but the other one would not. She just did not see anywhere in the definition, the term clothes, the basis to make a distinction based on the purpose of the clothes, whether it's, you know, if it's a protective purpose, if one jacket's purpose is to protect you from fire inside the workplace, then it's not clothing and you have to pay for that time. On the other hand, if the purpose of the clothes and the jacket in the bakery is to protect the food safety, protect it for sanitary reasons, then that would be considered clothing and you could exclude it. Also very skeptical, and I think passionately so, was Justice Scalia in rejecting the employer's definition, broader definition of clothes. He called, he basically castigated the counsel for U.S. Steel for trying to make a liar out of the court by adopting a definition that everything possible you have on your body is clothing. And I, quoting from the transcript, which is already online, by the way, Justice Scalia indicated that that nobody would consider eyeglasses or a wristwatch or some other specialized equipment to be clothes. That, of course, it was wonderful to try to eliminate all the problems on this issue by saying everything is clothing. It would make a lovely world, but it does not adhere to the statute which says clothes. On the other hand, of course, Justice Scalia told the told counsel for the employees that their own definition was peculiar. So what we had is regardless of whether you consider the justice a conservative justice or liberal justice, you know, we had four, we had, you know, Ginsburg, Sotomayor, Kagan, and Justice Scalia all rejecting the definitions proposed by both the employer and the employee and searching for some middle ground. They might have found it, actually, and to my surprise, in the proposal by the Department of Labor. What the Department of Labor is asking them to do is to say that that clothing is an article of clothing that worn on the body, but all and does not include like tools, like a tool belt or tools or a knife and a knife sheath, but that they would also include in the definition of clothes over which you can bargain and need not pay employees to do any ancillary activities. They focused on and characterized this as the activity of changing clothes. So what the government's attorney indicated was, for example, if a worker comes into a locker room, opens the locker, spends some time doing the combination on the locker, opens the locker, puts on a jacket and pants, which is clothing per se, but also happens to put on goggles or earplugs or even snap on a utility belt, that those activities like opening the locker, unlocking the locker, putting on the goggles are ancillary and incidental to changing into the actual clothing and therefore also non-compensable. The government's attorney did make a point to exclude from clothes and from Section 3O the type of protective chainmail type protective equipment worn in the meatpacking industry, and their distinction seems to be that when you're wearing basically chainmail all over your body, that is primarily equipment, not primarily clothes. So none of it can be considered clothing that's that over which you could bargain. This ancillary activity has not been in any of the opinion letters. It wasn't articulated in the amicus brief filed by DOL, so it was completely new in oral arguments. But, you know, my view of the oral argument was it was sort of the only middle ground that anybody gave to the justices, and I think that they were looking for that. Interestingly, Justice Kennedy did not ask a single question during this oral argument. Justice Roberts and Justice Alito seemed to be solidly in U.S. Steel's camp. And with that, Dean, I think I'm ready for questions.
Terrific. Let's open the floor to questions. In a moment, we'll all hear an announcement that will say the floor mode is on. After that, if you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. So once again, if you have a question for our expert today, Tammy McCutcheon, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Before we go to the first caller, let me make our typical program announcement. We've got a full slate this week of Teleforum calls tomorrow at 3 p.m. Eastern Time, another Courthouse Steps edition of Teleforum when we'll hear the Bond case. That's one of the biggest cases of the term, I think, answering the question whether the extent of authority of Congress can be expanded beyond its enumerated powers by the treaty power itself. That's tomorrow at 3 p.m. Eastern Time. On Wednesday at 2, another Courthouse Steps edition of Teleforum will be looking at the case Town of Greece, which is a legislative prayer case being argued in the Supreme Court this week. Then on Thursday, a book Teleforum with author Peter Schweitzer and Leo Connor. And then finally on Friday at a special early time, 11 a.m. Eastern Time, another Courthouse Steps edition of Teleforum, this one on the Medtronic case, which is an intellectual property case. Today, however, we're talking to our expert, Tammy McCutcheon, about the Sandifer, Darning, and Dauphin case. And looks like we have one caller. So after this first question, our lines will be open. You need to push the star button and then the pound button if you have a question.
John Rowland, Constitution.org. It seems we have an interplay here between a statute and a contract.
Yes.
And to what extent does the contract modify the statute in a way that would indicate that the definition of clothing has to be considered, be confined to the context of the contract rather than to the context of the statute.
That is absolutely right. And in fact, there was some discussion of that at oral arguments today. In particular, and just as a sort of little factoid off the record, when I was writing the opinion letter in 2002, I actually wanted to go further than what it's already drafted at and say that we should leave the definition of what's clothing to the collective bargaining process, because in my opinion, Congress intended to take this area out of DOL's purview and leave it to collective bargaining. And I think it's interesting in this case, because to the extent you say you're going to not allow the bargaining, you're taking bargaining rights away from the employees. On the other hand, the plaintiffs in this case clearly thought that their FLSA rights were being taken away. But it's not that clear cut, because both FLSA and the National Labor Relations Act do provide important rights and to employees. But in this particular case, and this is the only area where FLSA can trump collective bargaining. And I see this a lot in my practice where, for example, they'll put in the collective bargaining that they're going to pay a bonus, right? But they're not paying overtime on the bonus. It doesn't matter what they agreed in the collective bargaining agreement if it doesn't comply with the FLSA, except for in this one area. And in my opinion, because it is the only area that has been that Congress had taken out of the FLSA and put into the collective bargaining arena, clothing should be interpreted as broadly as possible. There was an interesting exchange today between Justice Breyer and Justice Roberts. Justice Roberts basically said, listen, it's collective bargaining. It happened in this case. They actually got it into the collective bargaining agreement. And, you know, if you assume that the Steelworkers Union is fulfilling its duty to fairly represent their employees, they had to have gotten something in exchange for giving up the right to be paid for this time. And he sees, you know, interestingly, the AFL-CIO wrote an amicus brief on behalf of the employees, but the steelworkers never came in. So, so Roberts took that and interpreted the fact that the steelworkers did not support the employees in this case, that they are happy with their bargain and they want to keep it and they prefer to be able to keep the bargain. On the other hand, Justice Breyer was, after asking some preliminary questions to understand the interaction between the contract and the FLSA, he seemed very bothered when he understood that the statute says that you don't have to pay for this time if it's either in the collective bargaining agreement or it's a established past practice, of course, but FLSA doesn't use the NLRA term, it uses customer practice. And he seemed very bothered that if there's just an established practice but with no actual agreements, the employees are losing out on their FLSA work time, their FLSA rights, for lack of a better term. I think that issue might have turned him, actually, on this. I think when he felt that employees were protected because it had to be in a collective bargaining agreement and it had to be bargained before they lost this time, he seemed comfortable. As soon as he understood that it could just be employees could lose this pay just because of a customer practice, that he became very concerned about that. He asked the government, the U.S. Steel, and the plaintiffs' counsel, all of them, about that issue and seemed very concerned. So it's really an interesting case because of the interaction between the contracts. But, you know, for this case, they don't have to be concerned because this is like the best possible facts for U.S. Steel and the employers. In this case, it's been in their collective bargaining agreement for 60 years. And think about that. If the Supreme Court reverses and says that this is paid time, the steelworkers, U.S. Steel will be liable for millions in back wages, even though the contract said they didn't have to pay the time. And I think that's really what Justice Roberts was focusing us on. They've already had the benefit of the bargain. And in this case, it was actually in the collective bargaining agreement. whether or not the case would be different for some of the justices if it wasn't actually in the agreement, I think it certainly would make a difference to Justice Breyer.
Well, no one else is in the queue yet. Do we have an indication of why the Supreme Court even took the case? This doesn't seem like a very earth-shattering issue for them to be taking up their time when there are thousands of other cases they could have taken up.
Isn't it odd? You know, it's like, oh, earth-shattering case today. What is clothing? There is actually a split in the circuits. You will not be surprised to know that the Ninth Circuit found that none of this stuff was clothing, and the Seventh Circuit, 7th, 10th, and a couple of others have held that it is clothing. So there is a split in the circuit, but as you know, there are many issues in which there's a split in the circuit. And what's really interesting here is there was the second issue in the case that I mentioned, whether the time from the locker room where the employees put on their clothing, walking to their workstation, whether that time has to be paid. And that is actually, in my mind, a more interesting issue, and there's also a split. There's a split on that issue, too. And normally, you know, put aside Section 3.0 and this whole bargaining stuff, normally if taking on and putting clothes is a primary activity, if that's the start of the workday, then the time from walking from where you put on your outfit to where your workstation is would also be work time. And the issue, that second issue that the Seventh Circuit ruled on was, well, since 3.0 has taken this clothing time and allowed the parties to bargain and not pay for it, does that still change the nature of the activity so it's not the start of the workday, right? Is that the start of the workday or not the start of the workday? When Section 3.0 comes into play. And the Supreme Court did not take up that issue, and there's still a circuit split on it. And, you know, in a lot of cases, that time is going to be significant, too. Not as significant as the time it takes to put on clothing. But it, in terms of dollars, it is significant. It's very easy, even if it's only 15 minutes at the end of the day, at the beginning and the end of the day, half an hour of the day, it can add up to $1 million and more, millions and millions, awfully, awfully quick. In my brief, I estimated in the grocery manufacturers in that industry, it would be about $1 million per 1,000 employees. And there are millions of employees in the industry. So from a monetary perspective, it's very significant. But you're right. I figure some the clerks must have, or the justices must have thought it would be a fun case to argue about, you know, what is clothing and what is not. And I will tell you, the employer, the petitioner's brief is hilarious because it starts talking about all these examples. Claiming that they're not clothing. So in the petitioner's brief, we got to read about everything from chainmail to scuba gear to lead-lined underpants. I kid you not. The first time, I'm sure, ever that the word lead-lined underpants has occurred in a Supreme Court brief. And, of course, the petitioner employees took the position that lead-lined underwear is not clothing.
Once again, if you have a question for our expert, Tammy McCutcheon, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. I want to both welcome our late callers and apologize. We had an email, a reminder email, or normal reminder email set to go out as this call began, and because of some problem with our, I guess, third-party provider here, it didn't go out until about 5 minutes ago. So we've got quite a few people joining late. Let me say to them, first, we apologize for the late notice, but second, we're having a good conversation here. Our lines are open. Push the star button and then the pound button if you want to ask a question. And I'd say give you special dispensation to ask any question you'd like, you know, knowing that some of you were not with us on the call from the start. And we don't have any callers in the queue right now, so push star and then pound if you'd like to ask a question. Let me ask a question, Tammy. You mentioned at the outset there wasn't a great deal of reaction from the court about the Department of Labor flip-flopping on its positions. I wonder if you want to go into more of that. I think you suggested there wasn't a great deal of reaction from the court, and that surprised you somewhat. Do you want to say more about that at all?
Certainly. And it does surprise me because the last time that there was a Fair Labor Standards Act case before the Supreme Court was Christopher versus GlaxoSmithKline. That was a 2012 case involving whether or not pharmaceutical sales reps qualified for the outside sales employee. And during that, and one of the issues in that case was, again, a flip-flop. Well, not so much a flip-flop. It was a first-time ever case. And what DOL had done is there had been three district court cases on the issue of pharmaceutical sales exemptions. It was the entire industry treated these employees as exempt outside sales, but of course the issue there was when you're selling pharmaceuticals, you go into a doctor's office, you convince them to prescribe your company's pharmaceuticals, but you're not actually finalizing transactionally a sale because you're actually prohibited by federal law from selling. But in that case, the DO, after two or three district court losses, the DOL started filing amicus briefs setting forth the position for the first time that these sales reps did not qualify for outside sales. And that's despite the fact that the industry has been selling the same way, you know, since the early 20th century. And the Supreme Court actually, Justice Scalia in the majority opinion, took them for task for their changes in position without notice to the industry, without giving, you know, not through notice and comment rulemaking, on not even really publicizing it much. So he took them for task for, like, coming up with this new position as amicus in litigation. And even the four justices in the minority of that case stated very briefly that they were not deferring to the Department of Labor's amicus brief. And to me, this case, it was even worse because we had, you know, Clinton said protective gear is not clothing. In Bush administration, we said it is clothing. Obama administration, it's not clothing. And then in the amicus brief, in this case, it is clothing, right? So four different positions since 1998. And even worse from my perspective, you know, in this case, they came in behalf of the U.S. Steel and they filed an amicus brief saying it's clothing, but the 2010 administrator's interpretation where they said it wasn't clothing is still posted on the Wage and Hour Division's website, whereas the 2002 and 2007 opinions of the Bush administrations are still shown on that website as withdrawn, even though the amicus brief takes the position in those opinion letters. I was very surprised, first of all, that DOL would file the amicus. If they had, and why? I mean, nobody really knows why. I wish I knew why. That would be really interesting. But, you know, did they actually decide that they were wrong in 2010? Or were they getting political pressure? I know some people have speculated since the Steelworkers Union did not come in on this case that the Steelworkers Union must have put some pressure on them to come in on the other side, but the AFL-CIO came in on behalf of the employees. And if you were – and put yourself in this – if you decide you're wrong and you're getting political pressure, why not just stay silent? Why file a brief that tells the Supreme Court that you were wrong in 2010? And then, of course, the government asked to have part of the time for oral arguments and participated in oral arguments. So I expected somebody, Justice Scalia, Justice Alito, somebody, to ask them about the flip-flopping positions, particularly because Judge Posner's commentary on that was rather amusing. He has, in the Seventh Circuit opinion, a little statement that, DOL did not suggest that the changing positions was political, because that would be a crass thing to admit in an appellate brief. But, you know, it's hard to get away from the idea that it was political. Of course, I thought we were right in 2002 and 2007. Absolutely correct. We got the right answer. But I just didn't understand. I'm just surprised. Not one question about the opinion letters. The opinion letters were not even mentioned by any of the justices during the oral argument. They were just questioning the government attorney based on his amicus brief. They did not mention or discuss why the amicus brief was a flip-flop, and so I'm not sure why. Maybe it's just so obvious that it's that they don't really have to defer to the Department of Labor that there was no reason to discuss it.
Well, it'll be interesting to see whether that shows up in the opinion of the court or any of the dissents. We do have another caller with a question, so let's go to our next caller. Once again, if you want to join the queue for the questions, we have just one more question on the line, then our lines are open. Push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone.
Hi, this is Matt Muggeridge. The case is very specific in that it's about clothing, but I was sort of thinking that it fit into a broader perspective of ways to attack employers, and the larger the employer, the better. But the way you were describing the case, they really were being specific just on clothing. Now, I was just reading recently that I think it was Amazon or Google, maybe. But when employees are entering work, they go through a security check, which takes like 20 minutes or whatever to get through. So, do you see this case as specifically about this issue of clothing and lead underpants, or do you see it as a broader part of the, you know, the general ways to attack employers that organize labor or the plaintiff bar or whatever forces are out there to make it more difficult to run a business?
I think it's mostly about the specific issue of changing clothes in a unionized workforce, but there are several things that are broader. And one of them has to do with the standards that DOL uses with de minimis. And this goes back to the new position that DOL took during oral arguments that the activity of clothes changing includes not only changing into jackets and pants, what we would all consider clothing, but any ancillary activities like putting on goggles or earplugs or unlocking a locker. One of the last questions that was asked, let me back up. The Seventh Circuit basically didn't deal with the issue of gloves, earplugs, hats, safety glasses. Instead, what they said, instead of what Judge Posner said, writing for the majority, is, well, the time you take to put on a hat is so de minimis, we don't have to worry about it because it can't be worked because it's so de minimis. One of the last questions that Justice Scalia asked the government was, well, why don't we just use a de minimis standard? Would you prefer us to use this ancillary or incidental type of standard to determine when these other, when you put on, whether or not putting up on a hat or earplugs is part of the changing clothes? And the government attorney said, we don't think he should use the de minimis standard. We think we would prefer like an incidental or ancillary activity standard. And when asked why, the government attorney was a little bit less than transparent on the answer. And basically said, well, the de minimis is a term of art, a legal term of art. It has a lot of other types of standards underneath it, and we just think that would add more questions. The real reason is that the Seventh Circuit's definition of de minimis is not the DOL's, right? And if the Supreme Court were to adopt Judge Posner's decision and say, well, the time you spend putting on a hat or earplugs is de minimis, so it's not work because it's de minimis, that would effectively overrule DOL's position on de minimis. And let me describe it. Most courts, when they look at this, a lot of courts, to be de minimis, it has to be something, an activity that takes only a few seconds or a few minutes. DOL adds two things to that, which most courts don't, and the Seventh Circuit doesn't. First, they say, well, you have to look at all the unpaid time a day in the aggregate, not that one activity only took you 30 seconds. Right, but if you have 10 activities that took you 30 seconds, right, now you've got some minutes going on, and so you have to look at all of the unpaid time collectively. The second issue is DOL adds a second part of the test. It's not just that the activity takes only a few seconds or a few minutes. The activity also has to occur infrequently and sporadically so that the work time is unpredictable and therefore difficult to track. So, and they have guidance published about this and there are some interpretations and in a field assistance bulletin on their website. If an activity, it takes only 30 seconds, but it happens every single day and the employer knows it happens every single day, that's not de minimis, right? So if you applied the DOL's de minimis standard, Judge Posner got that wrong. And I don't think that, and that is a very general application, because the DOL's de minimis standard really does make employers have to track a lot of little tiny pieces of time and pay for them in a way that's very burdensome. So I think it does have some broader implications, especially as I'm hoping that the Supreme Court says it's all de minimis and therefore doesn't have to be paid. The cases you mentioned, Matt, about the security checks, those are really, really interesting cases. And the new line of class actions, and it's happening. For example, Apple has been sued in several places in class actions, alleging they require employees to have their bags checked as they're exiting the store for lunch or at the end of their shift to make sure that they are not stealing anything from the Apple store. And the claims in those cases is that time is work time and has to be paid. And that's going to be something I'm watching very closely.
Once again, we're speaking with Tammy McCutcheon, our expert, about the Sandifer case. We've got another question, one question pending, then our lines are open. If you want to join the queue, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Let's go to our next caller.
John Rowland, Constitution.org, back. I raise a question in this matter concerning who's paying for the litigation by the plaintiffs. If their union is not backing it, then the amount of money at issue for the plaintiffs is far less by many orders of magnitude than it has obviously cost them to litigate it. So who has a financial stake in this case on the plaintiff's side that could be driving it, even if they're not a party?
Well, this is FLSA is a fee statute, so they do recover the plaintiff. This is all wage and hour, whether it's this case or any case. A lot of wage and hour cases, the actual harm and damages for each individual employee might be $1,000, $5,000. I mean, it can be very low, but it's in the aggregate and over 3 years. And so the I think the average settlement from a study at New York University, which they updated this year, the average settlement for one of these wage and hour class actions is about $7 million. And and one of the remedies in the FLSA is that the prevailing party does recover attorney's fees. A lot of times the attorney's fees end up being almost as much as the back wages. And so it is a money-making proposition for the plaintiff's bar, even if they're not backed by unions. So it is, this is it. This is how plaintiff's lawyers on the employment law side make their money, because you do not have to prove intent for a wage and hour violation, right? You either paid your employees correctly or you didn't. It doesn't matter whether or not the employer acted, thought they were doing good by their employees. And so it's a much easier case for a plaintiff's lawyer to litigate than, for example, a discrimination case where they have to prove intent to act in violation of the statute. So these are, and a lot of times it's very, there's a lot of times I will tell you these cases are very hard to defend. A lot of times you don't have any defense at all, and you're just arguing about how much. So they are definitely a money-making proposition for plaintiff's lawyers. Actually, you know, I just got in a new case for a client, and the plaintiff's lawyer is a patent attorney. You know, who's heard about all the money you can make during wage and hour class actions.
But if they lose at the Supreme Court level, would they not then get paid?
You're right. They will not recover at all if they're losing at the Supreme Court level. But they're obviously taking a risk. But, you know, these folks run a lot of cases at the same time, and they're not hurting. They're not hurting.
Let me make a final call for questions. Push the star button and the pound button if you have a question. And while we wait to see if there's a final question from the audience, let me ask you if you have a prediction about the outcome of the case, both which way it's going to go, and then is this going to be one of the cases that goes to the end of the term? Or are we going to get a result in the next couple months, or do you have any idea about that?
I don't, you know, it might take them a while to decide it. Because what I predict is, I think you, because of what we heard in oral arguments today with Justices Ginsburg, Justice Sotomayor, and Justice Kagan, along with Justice Roberts and Alito, you know, to me, you've got 5, 6, maybe even 7 justices who are going to vote for the U.S. deal to win the case. But they're not going to win as big as we all hope they do for a, you know, wide open definition of clothes. I think the definition of clothing will be narrower than what U.S. Steel and others in this line of business representing employers would hope for. Although I'm not sure they got what they wanted out of oral argument. I don't think they got a clear sort of middle of the road rule that allows you to include most things people as a matter of common sense. I think Sotomayor said it. It's like, we just want a common sense definition that doesn't exclude things like pants and jackets and shirts. On the other hand, and I do not think the Supreme Court will define clothing to include equipment or tools. Now, I think the difficulty, which might take them a while, is how do you distinguish between equipment, you know, a pair of chainmail gloves, is that equipment or is that clothing? And so I'm not sure that they will answer all the other thing, too, is they don't, I guess in this case, they don't have to answer all those questions. They could just say the clothing that are specifically at issue in this case is obviously clothes, and that's it. We're not going to define it any further. I think that would be disappointing because I think there are a lot of employers out there, unionized employers, who really do need to get a clear definition of what is clothing and what is not. So win for U.S. Steel, narrower definition of the term clothing than the employer community would like.
Looks like we do have one more question from the audience. We've got a few minutes left, so let's go to our next caller.
First, I want to thank you and the Federalist Society for what's really an interesting presentation. Forgive me if you covered this at the beginning of your talk, but I'm wondering what's the scope of this ruling and how it will apply. For example, will it apply to... Maybe I should ask the question in the negative. Where will it not apply? I suppose it would apply to all of the workers in the oil patch, elementary schools, a lot of non-union jobs, your local dog boarding kennel, every gas station. Is that correct?
Actually, it only applies in unionized workforces, right? Because if you're a non-union employer, you have to pay for donning and doffing time if you as the employer or the law itself requires the clothing to be – requires you to change into your work clothes at work. And just let me give you an example. I just did a deal investigation about Hootagirl uniforms, right? Hootagirls can change into their uniforms at home. So they don't have to be paid for that time. However, if the restaurant said, we don't want you wearing the Hootagirl outfit out on the street, you have to come in here first and change here, then you have to pay for that time. That's the general rule. This case is about a special rule in the FLSA that applies only when you have a union and allows you to negotiate with your union to exclude and not pay for that time. And so it's going to apply and be impactful in companies that have unions and have either a past practice or a collective bargaining agreement where they're not paying for the time to put on and take off all of this protective clothing, and that impact will be substantial. But it'll go against it's not just the steel workers; it's going to affect a lot of industries, most manufacturing industries, food processing industries where you have to wear protective clothing, healthcare where people are changing into, you know, their changing in and out of their uniforms at work before a non-exempt LPN is assisting in a surgery. She's going to change out of those clothing. Computer fabs, mostly major manufacturing, but any workforce that's unionized and that requires their employees to don and doff their work clothing at work rather than at home.
All right. Well, it sounds like we've exhausted all the questions from the audience. We've got a couple minutes left, Tammy. I don't know if you want to take a minute or two to wrap up or express any final thoughts.
I guess the last question is the impact narrow, and why did? And the other question: why did the Supreme Court take up this issue when it appears to be rather narrow, especially since, as we all know, the number of employees who are unionized keeps going down every year in the private sector. But I think it's an important issue because you're once again, and this is the same thing DOL was doing in Christopher versus GlaxoSmithKline, you're talking about imposing unexpected retroactive liability in the millions and millions and millions of dollars to employers who were never told they were doing anything wrong ever. And to me, it's a symptomatic of things that are going on, not just in the DOL, but in other agencies like the EEOC and the NLRB. And it's something we all need to pay attention to keep control of these agencies. And I'll put a plug in here, Dean, for your agency oversight project, your executive branch oversight project. I mean, this is what it's all about, is giving employers, companies, businesses a little bit of notice when there's going to be a change in the law so that they can comply with it in a fair manner. And that's why I think this is a bigger issue than just what is clothing. It's an issue about trying to impose new retroactive liabilities which no employer can plan for in their budget and can devastate a business.
Well, let me thank you, Tammy McCutcheon, both for your unsolicited plug, but most especially for attending oral argument today, and then for catering to our audience here today. And again, to the audience, I apologize for the late notice on the reminder, but do be reminded of our upcoming schedule. We have four more teleforum calls this week, as I mentioned at the outset, tomorrow at 3, Wednesday at 2, Thursday at noon, and then Friday at 11 a.m. They're all on our website, so I encourage you to take a look at the website and join us for our next teleforum conference call. But until then, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.